Be loud and be proud and back the boys and make some noise. Come on, you Oz!
Shout out to this week's podcast sponsor, ZCZ Films, showing that age is no barrier to being a hooly hoop.
Hello and welcome to the Tarnhurst End podcast with your host Mark Mayo and a very special edition of the podcast, indeed with the former Reading striker Nicky Forster joining us for this edition of the show. And to interview him with myself is Marco Bada popping in as he did for the Ivo Ingemarsson interview, joining us having a prime spot to ask Nicky all the questions. And Marco, thanks very much for helping us out with this interview and for joining us this evening.
Yeah, thanks for having me with you. Always a pleasure.
Nicky Forster, how's it going, mate?
Yeah, good. Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's always nice to talk. Not many people listen to my stories anymore, so it's nice when someone wants to.
Oh, there is absolutely plenty of space for your stories on the Tarnhurst End. Don't worry about that, Nicky. And we'll be getting on to talk all things playoffs and promotions and all the rest of it in a little bit. But let's start off by getting to know a bit more about your sort of pre-Reading career. As you were born in Caterham in Surrey, and kind of if you can give us an insight into your sort of favourite clubs and players as you were growing up, and also whether football was actually your main passion in terms of sport as you were growing up.
Well, I mean, the answer is it always was. I had an elder brother and a younger brother, so I sandwiched in the middle of two brothers. So, you know, there was always a lot of competition, even at the dining table every single day when my mum came out and put a row of fish fingers. There was competition for fish fingers or whatever the actual meal was of choice. So I grew up in a highly competitive environment, and my elder brother, a really good footballer himself, and you know, we used to spend a lot of time playing football together in the house, outside the house, from as early as I can remember. So he certainly, my elder brother, Dave, was instrumental in me falling in love with sport and competition and football, and he certainly was one of the three people that developed a real mindset in terms of sort of a mental resistance, I had to call on that throughout my life and throughout football. And indeed, for one of the big blows of my career was whilst in, you know, at Reading. So my young memory is certainly playing football and all sports, but certainly football with my brother.
And you started in non-league, then enjoyed success at Gillingham and Brentford. And one of your partners in the Brentford attack was Carlos Saba. Have you ever discussed his less positive time at Reading?
Do you know what? No, I mean, Carl and I, Carl came to Reading or came through the ranks at Reading towards the end of my time. And as Carl sort of grew and became more prolific, I think Dave Webb, the manager, saw that as a reason for me to move on. They were a club at that time, Brentford, who were buying players from lower divisions. The manager, Dave Webb, ex-Chelsea player, he had a good eye for bringing players in. And he did that from lower leagues and sold them on. And I think it was just my time to move on, make some money for the club. And I got my move to Birmingham. So you know, my time with Carl was fairly short. We were competing for the same place. So if I played, he didn't. He played, I didn't. And so, I mean, when we get together, we always chat. And, in terms of talking about old clubs and playing together, there wasn't a huge amount of it, actually.
Yeah, and that spell at Birmingham you mentioned there was actually, it did bring you to Reading in January 1998. You had a trip to Elm Park, and unfortunately for you, on the wrong end of the scoreline that day with Reading winning 2-0. I wanted to know whether you have any memories of Elm Park, obviously a stadium that was at its kind of the end of its lifespan at that time, and turning up as an opposition player, what you kind of remember of that day.
Yeah, do you know what? I do remember the game, and I can't remember. I presume it must have been in and around this sort of Christmas period, because I remember the pitch being really bad. Yeah. I remember it being a bit of a tussle, a bit of a battle, and we sort of got a bit beaten up, really. I mean, Birmingham at the time were underachieving, had some amazing names. I mean, when I look back at the players I played with at Birmingham, you know, the names of the players, I mean, Barry Horn, Steve Bruce, Paul Furlong, Mike Newell, Gary Ablett, you know, Premier League household names. And on the day, I remember us getting sort of roughed up. I remember Paul Furlong got sent off, and it was a funny story because I don't even know who he tussled with. I've got a good idea. It's probably Parky, because he's the sort of guy that would rustle furs. And I remember Paul Furlong got sent off, and Trevor Francis afterwards at the end of the game said, why haven't we got any kidology about us? Why haven't we, you know, furs, when someone comes up and puts their head in your face, why don't you go down and hold your face and get him sent off? And it was a little bit of sort of at that time, I mean, it would be frowned upon now, that sort of talk, but it was a little bit of sort of gamesmanship, what we'd perhaps call in those days. But I remember Paul Furlong looked at Trevor Francis and said, Trevor, we were brought up from very different places. And Furs's answer was to fight fire with fire. And I remember Furs got sent off. And all I remember, it was a scruffy game. It was a difficult place to go. The place, as you say, looked tired. It looked like an old fashioned club that hadn't perhaps been maintained. Might be disrespectful, but when you look at grounds now compared to the new stadia that people play in, the ones that have got that little bit of a sort of a weathered sort of and worn look about them do look very dated, and it did at the time.
And after 2.5 years with Birmingham, you signed in the summer of 99 for the Royals. What convinced you to make the move to Reading, and what kind of stage did you find the club in?
Yeah, I mean, do you know what? There's a story with that one as well, because the club that was repeatedly coming in for me at my time at Birmingham was Preston North End, and at the time David Moyes was the manager, and they came in for me at the end of the season. I went up there. I had a medical. Funnily enough, I failed the medical on the grounds that I had a knee injury at Birmingham, long-term knee injury, and as a result, I failed the medical, and they asked me to have an MRI scan. So that delayed me sort of putting pen to paper. I finally had the MRI scan, and they said that the knee was okay, and they offered me a contract. In that time of that delay, Reading came in for me, and my agent Eric Hall, who's no longer with us, sadly passed away recently. He said that there's a club that's come in, Reading, and we had to drive back down because it was a Friday, and I remember asking for some time over the weekend just to commit to Preston. And on the way back down the M6, the M40, we stopped in at Reading. I had a chat to the manager, Tommy Burns, showed me the ground, and he sold it to me. And the moment I saw the ground, the moment I saw the place, it just felt right. I don't know why, and people say that, but it was just an instinct that I got that I could play football here, and I think I'd be happy here. It was closer to home. It was sort of in and around that sort of southern area where I'm from. It just felt right. And I phoned David Moyes, and he was furious. And I'm sure he must have seen it before and subsequently loads of times since. But he was absolutely furious. And I never forget, about 3 days later, I got a bill come through the post to Reading's ground. I've got given it by one of the staff at Reading. And it was a bill for an MRI for my knee scan at Preston. £800 bill for an MRI. So I filed that in the bin, and then I just got on with my career at Reading.
Yeah, you mentioned Tommy Burns there. He was the manager only for, you know, effectively the first couple of weeks of you being at the club. And how did that kind of unfold, I suppose, with his kind of departure, and then obviously Alan Pardew taking over from him?
Yeah, I mean, Tommy no longer with us, similar to Eric, and such a sad story. But Tommy, he was a really passionate man about football, about football and the game. But where he fell down, and what I could see quite quickly from being there, is in his intensity and how intense he was. In some ways, it was lost with some of the players. He was used to dealing with and training with and playing with and managing with the elite level, you know, whether it was in Scotland or wherever it was. And we weren't quite there at that point, obviously, the players he was playing with. And he found that difficult to transcend those standards and perhaps deal with players that weren't quite as good. And he was so intense that the sessions that we had, if they didn't quite go to plan, would be out there deliberating over it for almost hour upon hour upon hour. We'd go out and training at 10:30 in the morning, and sometimes 2 o'clock in the afternoon we'd still be there, which on the face of it doesn't sound like a long day, but when you're training from 10:30 to 2-3 o'clock and you haven't had a break, suddenly the body needs food, it needs hydration, and we hadn't done that. And I think he just lost some of the players, and at that time there were some really strong characters. There was quite a culture of socializing, shall we say. And it just lent itself. It was almost like trying to bang the saying is a square peg in a round hole. It just didn't quite work. And sadly for him, it didn't work.
Mm.
In terms of Alan coming in, Pards came in. And the moment Pards came in, he tried to lift the place. In fact, now a lot of my role now is I do a lot of motivational keynote speaking, and I deal with goal setting, and some of the stuff that I touch on is stuff that Pard taught me and taught us, and you know, it was instrumental in forming me as a player and loads of us. You know, Andy Hughes responded to it, you know, was brilliant with it, and it was brilliant. He came in, I never forget, he came in, and within the first few days he said, right, I want everyone to come back to the ground after the game. And we went back after training, and we went back to the ground, and he started setting up some goals for us. He set some goals for us, and we all joined in deciding what we were going to do to try and transform ourselves from a team that was underperforming towards the bottom of the league to a team that was challenging for promotion. And the way he did that was for me at the time revolutionary, and it gave us all a direction, a focus. You know, we were all heading in the right direction. And Martin Allen, to be fair, played his part in that as well. He was really good at galvanizing us all together, because we were quite soft in lots of ways. And we went and had some great performances. Preston away was one where we went away from home. They were top of the league, top of the table. Obviously, that was difficult, obviously, with my situation. And we went there, and he ruffled feathers, Martin did. And I never forget that game. I don't know if you guys have heard this, but we went to Preston, Deepdale, and to try and unsettle them, and they were on a really good run of form, Preston, Martin Allen, said to everyone, we are going to try warm up in the same half as Preston. So whatever half they choose to warm up, we're going to go and warm up in the same half. So both teams all warmed up in the same area. And they really didn't like that, kicked off. I mean, two goalies were trying to practice their catching in one goal. And the referee come up and said, look, you can't do this. He was like, why can't we? There's no reason why we can't. So he was very good at ruffling people's feathers, and he used it to our advantage. So, you know, Pards was instrumental for me. I know sometimes, you know, people sort of either sort of go one way or the other with Pards, love or hate, you know, and for me, he was brilliant.
Yeah, I remember speaking to Martin Allen some month ago, and he was talking about that Preston game and saying as well that after the draw, he was dancing in the way to provocate the opponent, and was explaining it the same way like you did.
It was like nothing I've ever seen before, and probably nothing I've ever seen since. I mean, you know, some of the stories of Martin Allen are brilliant, almost unbelievable, unless you'd lived them.
You played with a few players who would go on to help Reading win the league. You think Graham Murty, Steve Sidwell, Nicky Shorey, James Harper, Glenn Little had that in them in your early days at the club?
Well, absolutely. I mean, a pretty similar bunch of players, bar for a few extras, went very close a few seasons prior to that when we lost out to Wolves in the playoff semi-final. And, you know, Steve Coppell came in, and Pards moved on. I think Pards went to West Ham. Then Steve Coppell came in, and again, he was he's a manager out of all the managers I've played under, the ones I respect the most. Two of them are Reading, certainly. And you know, Alan Pardew and Steve Koppel. I mean, Steve was an amazing, or is an amazing man in my eyes. And it was no surprise to me that they went on and won the league the way they did. I mean, Mertz is an ever, you know, ever present performer. Sidders, we know how good Sidders was. I mean, he signed from, you know, for Chelsea from there under Mourinho. You know, the core of the squad, they got Doyle up front as well. So, you know, there was, you know, there was some clever purchases. Kitson came from a lower club, another example of Steve Koppel's genius, buying a player in, I think Cambridge it was, came in and he just sort of set the league alight. And, you know, it was no surprise to me that they did so well.
Yeah, one other player of that era who unfortunately wasn't involved in that sort of 05-06 team, but certainly a legend of the club, was Phil Parkinson. And a lot of, I suppose, a lot of fans, younger fans particularly today, obviously, you know, they'll hear of the legends of him, but they'll never have watched him play. So, to those sort of supporters, how would you describe him to a young fan today as how instrumental he was at the club?
Well, I touched on my brother being a real influence on me in terms of developing my mental strength as I was a kid growing up. The other guy that did that was Phil Parkinson. When I came into the club, he was just an absolute leader. And if I was to explain him to someone else, it doesn't work with the question you've asked me, but I would say he's akin to a bit of a Martin Johnson, who was the old England forward, the old England rugby union player, captained the British Lions, and just an absolute leader. He was like that, and it won't resonate with the younger viewers. But Parky, in terms of how would I relate him to someone today? Do you know what? Picking someone off the top of my head at the moment, I'm not too sure, but he was, Stephen Gerrard was a leader in a different sort of way. Parky led, but he was a leader like that, an incredible motivator. He led with his actions, not just his words. He was fiercely committed, fiercely passionate about everyone, rolling their socks up. And, you know, Sean Dyche, someone said to me, Sean Dyche, when he signs a player, the things he looks for are four words, and that is minimum requirement is maximum effort. And if I was to sum Parky up, that is Parky, his minimum requirement every single game from every player was that they gave maximum effort, regardless of quality. If sometimes you don't have such a good game, or your quality isn't there, if you're not perhaps, you know, as good as another player, as long as you are giving 100% effort, every single ounce that you've got, that would do for Parky. And I not only played with Parky, I played underneath Parky in terms of he managed me when I signed for Charlton. And Parky, I could ring Parky up and chat to him about anything, or if I had a problem. And in fact, when I took over at Brentford as a manager for seven months or so, very often I used to ring Parky and ask for his opinion, his advice on things, and he was always forthcoming with it.
And your opinion, who was the most talented player you played with at Reading?
The most talented player I played with at Reading. Well, in a roundabout way, he'll love me and he'll talk forever. Glenn Little was brilliant at just creating something. I mean, it looked like he was running down a blind alley, but he'd sort of get round and get across in the box and feed people. Talented. I think Andy Hughes was a really undervalued, underrated player. And if I was, someone asked me who my favourite player to play up front with, my time there would be, or indeed throughout my career, I'd probably say Andy Hughes as a number one, because I quite liked the lone striker role up front with Hughesy just playing just in behind me, that number 10 role. He did it so well. And that season that we lost out in the Championship playoff semi-final against Wolves, you know, was possibly the best football I've ever played. And Hughesy was instrumental in me playing as well as I did.
Yeah, just to bring you forward a little bit after your, because after your first season, you scored 10 goals. And then I know you mentioned earlier the injury that you suffered, quite a bad cruciate ligament injury the following year. To kind of unpack that a little bit, how difficult was it to motivate yourself as you were kind of on the way back from that, especially with the team that was pushing for promotion at that time?
Well, how difficult was it? It wasn't difficult at all. As I say, there's some characters in my career, in my life, that have helped me through those times. Parky's one, my brother's another, and a physio at Birmingham when I did the other cruciate, which is I mentioned earlier about a long-term injury I had at Birmingham, and that was a cruciate ligament on the other knee when my time at Birmingham, and the physio there was instrumental in helping me grow as a character, as a person. So how tough was it? I remember the injury. It was against Charlton in the last pre-season game before we kicked off the following Saturday. So it was a difficult blow in terms of to have completed the whole of pre-season and get myself physically, mentally prepared for the game, the season kicking off the following week, and then to bang, lose it just in one moment like that was particularly tough. But I remember going into the office after my scan and Pard said to me, "Foz, the news isn't good. You've done this. You've done your cruciate." So having done it before, I knew what it meant. And I remember him saying to me, and I'll never forget it, he said, "You won't play a game this season." And I remember thinking then and there straight away, and I said straight back, I mean, I literally welled up because of the emotion. And I remember saying, "I will play a game this season, Pards. I tell you now, I will have a part to play in this season." And I use it sometimes in my motivational speeches because not only, I mean, it was really hard seeing everyone kick off. Kuro was brought in, played up front with Butts. I was due to play with Butts that season. We were linking a really nice partnership. I mean, Kuro came in and is now a legend of the club, obviously, as we know. And it was hard just week after week after week after week, just seeing them score, win games and just moving forward. And not being part of that. That was tough, but I set myself targets, get my leg straight. I mean, the first thing I had to do was actually straighten the knee. The leg had to become straight, get a full flexion in the knee. So I started setting myself mini goals straight away and started running at 3 months, started multi-directionals, changing directions on the training ground at 4 months, some contact stuff at 5 months, back to playing at 6 months, which meant I could play before the end of the season. And I did. And I came back and I scored. I can't remember who it was against. I was put on, I think, on the right side or the left side. And I scored a goal. And then that we finished in the playoffs. And then we had that magical night against Wigan. And, you know, it was, you know, for me, one of the great achievements of my career. I think it goes down as number two in the greatest games at the Madejski Stadium. So it was just unbelievable. So I set myself a goal of being a pivotal part of that season, and I believe I was.
Yeah, as you talked about it, I mean, the playoff semi-final against Wigan in 2001 is seen by many as the night the Madejski became home. What are your memories of that night, especially? Because later on we will ask you also about the goal, the penalty kick from Kuro. But what were your memories of that night, especially regarding the atmosphere?
I mean, listen, when you come back from a really long-term injury, and you know, it probably resonates with people at any level of football. It's not just elite, but when you are judged in front of a crowd, an audience of thousands of people, there's no place to hide. You've got to be performing at a decent level. Otherwise, you'll get found out, or you people say, "Well, he's not ready. He's not fit. Is he right? Why is he out there?" What, you know, and when you've got games like that. So going into the game, I was hoping I was going to play. I was hoping I was going to start. Kuro and Butts had done too well for me to play in either one of the forward roles. So the only place I could play would be on the right. Wasn't a favoured position for me, but just wanted to play. And I remember Pards pulling me and say, "Foz, you're gonna be on the bench." I was gutted, but okay, fair enough. And I just remember the night when we all warmed up, and I just remember it. There was an atmosphere. There was a deep sort of fog or mist. I don't know if you guys can remember, but it was almost difficult to see from one end of the stadium. So it was almost like I don't know, almost like a sort of a war zone sort of feel to it, where it was like very tense, very atmospheric. You could feel the pressure in terms of, weather-wise, and then there was a pressure to win the game. And then we conceded quite early on. I don't know, was it something like 19th minute? It was a sort of fluky goal that went under the wall.
Okay.
And, don't forget that they had some big name characters themselves, Roy Carroll in goal, Dazou at the back, Martinez played, I think, Roberto Martinez, who's now manager of Belgium. So it was a really charged atmosphere. And I remember coming on with not much to go at all towards the end. It was, I'm sure, a throw of the dice, a last throw of the dice. And I've watched it a number of times, and that ball out to me. And as soon as I could get round the back and I knew he was going to come in for the tackle, I thought, I don't need to try and cross. I just try and wait for the contact. And there was enough contact, and I always made it look good anyway. So, the moment we got the penalty, I just thought, Kuro won't miss, and we're back in it. We've got extra time. So that at least I've got another 30 minutes of football here, which I thought, for me, is great. You know, we're back in the game, which is the biggest bonus of all, but I've got 30 minutes of football, 30 minutes of playing time to sort of get myself, into the game, get involved and try and win this game. And then we'll go Wembley or Millennium, which it was at the time. And sure enough, the ball broke out to me again. And the Kuro took the penalty. The guy, Roy Carroll, parried it out, and I just managed to score. The scenes were just unbelievable. I think it was two goals in what, 3 minutes or something like that, or less than that. It was just, and then it was just pandemonium, because I remember there was mounted police. Do you remember mounted police on the pitch? And again, there was fans jumping on, and the ref kicked the game off, and people were still sort of stood around the edge of the pitch rather than getting them back in the seats. And it was carnage, really, but just incredible atmosphere, just amazing, amazing memory.
Yeah, and you kind of hinted at it there, that when, as I've always wondered, because it gets talked about by, pundits kind of say, wait for the contact, look for the contact. But in the moment, being a striker kind of in that sort of game, as you've waited for it, but basically the entire season that you've been out, you said then you kind of knew you were going to get a touch. At what point do you kind of, think it's got to happen now? Because obviously if you just run it out of play, then you really have kind of messed up. So it's a bit of a risky sense, isn't it, kind of thing?
You have a look at it as well, I had no more place to go, because it was right on the byline as well, sort of on the 6 yard the corner of the 6 yard box on the byline, so there was nowhere else to go unless cut in. And but because I'd got a run on him, and he probably didn't want me to cut in and then sort of square it back or pull it back for a tap in, he thought he had to make the tackle. The hero for me when I was growing up, Kevin Keegan, but as a professional footballer, the one I looked at and tried to learn off more than anyone else was Alan Shearer. And what he lacked in pace, he was incredibly clever at when the ball was in front of him, he'd chase at the ball, as quick as he could, and get himself, he'd always maneuver himself in between himself, he'd put himself in between the defender and the ball. So as the defender was running back, any sort of contact, he'd go down. And Shearer just got countless penalties by getting himself in a good position and almost drawing the tackle in. Certainly if he was in a poor angle and he thought, you know what, if I draw the defender in, they'd run it almost clattering to the back of him, knock him down. He used to make it look really good. And, I had that ability as well. Arms and legs went everywhere, and I think the ref thinks, well, there must be contact. To be fair, I rarely got penalties or rarely I went down unless there was some contact. I didn't make a career of cheating. And there have been times in my career where I've gone down thinking the tackle was going to come, gone down, and I put my hands up and said, ref, there was no contact. So I sort of tried to be fair.
And in general, later on, you already talked about final at Cardiff. Why do you think Reading have such rotten playoff final luck?
Do you know what? I don't know. I don't know, because they've had some of the best games ever in the Reading's history have been final games that they've lost, as you know. Do you know what I mean? So AD Williams talks about the final that was that against Bolton that they lost, and
95,
just incredible. But what is it? I don't know. Maybe it's a belief thing. Maybe it is. I don't think it would be a preparation thing, but maybe it is a. You know, in those both those examples, and certainly when we went and played against Wolves a couple of seasons later, there was almost a feeling that we were overachieving, that we weren't ready for the Premier League, that perhaps, you know, Wolves are a big club. They're probably better placed to be in the Premier League than lowly us, Reading, you know, with our, you know, Andy Hughes, Nicky Forster, you know, Steve Sidwell, James Harper, Nicky Shorey, you know, not Premier League players. Well, they all turned out, most of them, to be Premier. Well, only Nicky Forster didn't be a Premier League player. You know, I don't know whether it's belief. I don't know whether it was just fate. I don't know the answer to the question. But I think sometimes belief goes a long way in determining fate, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose the next season, obviously, you know, it turned out to be the successful season that Reading were hoping for. And I suppose the fact that the playoff final had been lost, Reading were among the favourites for promotion that season. I suppose there's a lot of pressure coming with that. How happy were you with your kind of own performance over that season? You topped the scoring charts with 18 goals. Mm. Obviously, kind of shook off the injury-prone tag from maybe the season before. So, for you personally, as well as a team performance, it was a good performance that next year.
Yeah, I mean, I was a greedy striker. There's no doubt about it. I wanted to be top scorer, and that's why it was so hard seeing Kuro and Butts banging in goals week in, week out. And you know, I wanted to be there. I wanted to be part of that. So, you know, to be top scorer was a real privilege. I was really proud of it. I managed to get in the following year, I got in the team of the year, or maybe that year I got in the team of the year. So, you know, it was a super proud year for me. You know, it was a reward, I think, for the hard work and the sacrifices I made coming back from my injury. I mean, the cruciate ligament injury is a tough injury to come back from. It's, you know, it's a brutal injury, and the rehab of it is tough. You've got to be mentally prepared for it. And, you know, it was a culmination that season of not only just the work that I put in for that season, but the whole of the previous season, strengthening myself, working really hard. You know, all those hours of sessions I did strengthening my leg, going up. I went up to Birmingham from Reading twice a week to use what's called an isokinetic kinetic machine, which really works the leg and strengthens the muscles through different stages of flexion of the knee. And and all those sessions I drove up there, did those weights, came back. You know, that was reward for those.
And how did it feel? For you, winning promotion at one of your old clubs then, where you enjoyed plenty of success at Brentford?
Yeah, I mean, I played on the right-hand side that season played on the right-hand side on that final game. And funnily enough, I saw it recently on a social media site. Someone put the clip of Kuro, and it really is an excellent finish. I mean, we know Kuro is the best finisher I've played with. He's just phenomenal. And you know, I saw it recently and it was a super finish. And I mean, it was just an amazing, amazing, amazing day. The whole thing was just incredible. And I remember us coming back along the M4 and there was fans either side of the coaches. It was a lot of traffic. So it was stop, start, there were fans clapping, hanging out the windows, sunroofs, the lot. And we got back to the Madejski Stadium and there were people pushed up against the door of the coach. We couldn't get out the coach, so we all got up through the roof and stood on the top. And I've got this great picture of the fan of the team standing on top of the coach and celebrating with the fans. I mean, half of the team took their tops off and went bare chested, which I don't understand why we did that. But I was obviously one of the clowns that did that day. But it was a listen. They're the things that You know, we play football and we love the game, but they're the special moments. Scoring a goal is special. I've always said that's, for me, is the great buzz. But those moments of success and large-scale success, which over 46 league games, that's a huge achievement. Winning one game of football is one thing, but being promoted, you know, is an incredible achievement. It really is.
Yeah, and it just makes me think as well, for obviously, you know, I'm sure the celebrations after then must have been, you know, very satisfying and everything. But what does it feel, I suppose, the kind of 2 weeks after that, 3 weeks after that, at what point does your mind settle down and kind of start thinking about the new season? And as a striker, I suppose, to be at that level, what was kind of going through your mind in the kind of weeks after that?
Well, you know, I'm a goal setter. I've always done that. That's been my career. Obviously, as a goal scorer, I'm setting targets and looking to score goals every single time I go out on the pitch. So for me, that process started pretty quickly. You know, I go away, I enjoy. We had a trip away to celebrate the players, and then came back and we went away off with our respective families on holiday. And that's when I started thinking, right, okay, you know, you're stepping up a league now. You know, you've got to be better again, you know, and how am I going to do that? How am I going to prepare mentally, physically to do that? And the following season was a great season for us too.
You're listening to the Tilehurst End podcast by Reading fans for Reading fans.
Then what do you think was added to that team to make it ready for the championship? I mean, you won promotion, you were in that Division 2 season, you were the favourite, and then you had to perform at a higher level. What was added to the team?
Well, there were a number of things. I think we had a good core of an excellent team. And Pards brought in some excellent players. Steve Sidwell is one. But the one that I think came in for me and made me look and think, wow, geez, that is a step above anything I've ever seen, was Matthew Upson. He came in, and in fact, he played, I remember he left AD out, I think, second game of the season, which was a League Cup game, I believe, against Cambridge away. And we might have even got beaten. I can't remember. Matthew Upson played. And I remember thinking, wow, he came from Arsenal. You obviously sort of, he was a, you know what he was like, but he was tall, commanding, physical. And I thought, oh my God, that is a new level. And, you know, so the likes, we had John Solarco, we had Steve Sidwell, you know, so the team did shift, did change. The likes of Marcus Hanneman stepped up to the plate and was phenomenal. I'll never forget some of the saves he made in that playoff game away at Molineux when we won 1-0 or drew 1-1, I think it was just unbelievable. Just pulled them out of every angle. I remember, because sometimes, obviously, when a team is attacking us, I'm at the halfway line preparing for the ball to come back up to me. You know, argument is perhaps I should have been working harder for the team. But anyway, at the halfway line, sometimes when I'm looking, or certainly if there's a free kick in and around the box and I'm not involved, I can see it. And sometimes you can see it curling and you think, oh my God, that's in. And then suddenly a finger comes out and he tips it around the corner. So he was just out of this world. You know, I think all of us, to be honest with you, stepped up. You know, I think I scored 18 that season as well. So we all stepped up again to the next level. And, you know, and to be fair to Pards, he started drawing in some bigger name players. I don't know whether it was that season that we got Les Ferdinand in, and it might have been after that Les came in, the season after, I'm not sure. But
yeah.
We just started to attract that, you know, players up their game, and we just started to attract that better player, quality player as well.
And for yourself, it's interesting, I suppose, to compare, as you say, the goal tallies were pretty similar from one season to the next. Would you say that 2002-03 season, obviously getting into the playoff semi-final and scoring in that, would you say that is probably your best season that you had?
Yeah, if someone says to me, there's two answers to it. If someone says, what's your favourite season or what's your best season? I think the answer to your question there is that the my best season, the best football I've played at the highest level I've ever played was that season there, where I played up front. I played alongside Husey or Husey just in behind me. I was served from on the right-hand side by Glenn Little, served on the left-hand side by John Solarco. Those guys, 8 times out of 10, they got the ball out wide. The ball was coming in the box. So I just knew the ball was coming. Every time Husey got it to feet, and he was a phenomenal athlete, and so was James Harper. Every time those guys got the ball, I knew that they were looking for me. It was a great feeling. And whereas I was quite small, what I could do when I was with two centre halves, I would just drop myself in between the pair of them. And I found that quite a cute way in terms of neither of them knew which one was picking me up at times. It was like, I thought you were picking him up. No, I thought you were picking him up. And by that time, if the ball's over the top, I was gone. So, we overachieved, really, if you look at the actual squad, but we had some good players. I mean, Steve Brown at the back, Graham Murty, Nicky Shorey, A.D. Williams. You know, we had an engine in midfield of Husey and Harps and Sidders. I mean, just energy to burn. And then out wide, the two wide boys, as I say, got 8 out of 10 times they got the ball, they put a ball in the box. So as a centre forward, that was just brilliant.
And as you said, for most of the time in that first year back in Division One, you were operating as a lone striker. Would you say that playing alone up front suited your abilities best?
Well, yeah, for the same reason I just said, is that very often when there's two of you up front, very often one defender will take one striker and the other will take the other. So it's one person, you know, you take him, I'll take him. But when there's only one striker, I used to pull off between the two and spend a lot of my time in between the two, you know, defenders. And as I say, it's very hard for them to know which one's got me. Have you got him or have I got him? Unless they were very well drilled. It lent itself to me and my style of play, which is if they switch off for a moment and then the ball goes over top, I'm in, I'm after it, I'm onto it. And, you know, that's how we scored a lot of goals. That's how I scored a lot of goals. Enjoyed myself.
Yeah, and that season ended with the playoff semi-final against Wolves. And it was such a... I remember watching that game against Molineux and it seemed to, you know, for the first hour, everything was going brilliantly. You'd scored a good goal. Reading were certainly holding their own at such a big stage. But ultimately, you came off injured just about the hour mark, I think it was. And it kind of felt as if the game and ultimately the season collapsed from there. And I wonder how that moment was for you, obviously coming off and then Wolves scoring 2 goals and running out a red card right at the end.
Yeah, I mean, I remember coming into training one day and I used to go in with Steve Brown, John Solarco and Steve Sidwell. We shared a drive in, all of us. And I remember Brownie saying, the problem we've got is if you get injured, Foz, because we play with one up front and we're over-reliant on you in terms of your pace, your outlet and how we set ourselves up. There's no one else that does that. That's not detracting from other strikers. It's just saying, you know, we haven't got that fill if you get injured. And unfortunately, that's what happened. And I'll never forget the injury because it was a stupid injury from my point of view, is that their fullback, left-back, Naylor, Lee Naylor, I think his name is, and he was shepherding the ball out. And I should have just let it go out. We were winning 1-0. I should have just let the ball roll out. It was on about the halfway line, in and around the dugouts. And I tried to sort of get round the back of him and he just nudged and we caught each other and I felt my ankle go straight away. I knew it had gone straight away. I couldn't move. I remember going into the changing room straight away and I thought, that's it. I've got no chance. There's just no way I will play. All I thought about is, will I be okay? I think it was Saturday and Tuesday we played. Will I be okay for the Tuesday? And I just knew I wouldn't. It was just a gutting feeling. It really was. And I remember the physio sort of saying, John Fern, he said, well, let's have a look at it in the morning. But I knew. I'd done it too many times before to know the extent of it and to know how long it would take to come back from. So it was such an anticlimax. It was such a devastating blow to me personally. I remember as everyone walked out on the pitch on the night, the following game, and I just remember just being just devastated, just emotionally just drained and almost in tears, I think, because I just thought, you know, this was meant to be, not to be sat up in the stands like I was. And it wasn't meant to be, sadly. So it was highs and lows of life, I'm afraid.
Then did the second leg defeat demonstrate in some way also how the club had hit its ceiling for that period of time? And was it also, in your point of view, the one chance at playing in the Premier League gone?
No, I didn't think it was my only chance to play in the Premier League gone. I thought that it was an opportunity for us as a club that we missed. And, you know, we were riding the crest of a wave. And I always say, and people say to me, what was Pards like? And for me, Pards was brilliant at making people feel special, making people feeling like they were riding on top of the, you know, a crest of a wave. And we just kept going. Our momentum was there. And he was brilliant at that, Pards. And we were riding it, and it just dropped off. And that was hard to take. But listen, we all know it's football. It happens. And, you know, it was the beginning of the end. And I think, though, the success that Pards got with that helped him, that squad helped him get the move that perhaps he was looking for, which is that big move to the Premier League, which I think was West Ham, or I think they were in the Championship as well at the time. I think they were a Championship team. He took over West Ham, didn't he, and got them promoted.
Yeah, there were quite a few memorable games between Reading and West Ham after Pardew had gone, and obviously, you know, the fans, kind of the Judas atmosphere and that sort of stuff. And ultimately, it kind of worked in Reading's favour because they got a couple of good results against West Ham. I was wondering how much did Pardew's exit sort of impact yourself at the club? And I was also wondering whether you ever actually got the call to go and join him at West Ham.
Well, the answer is, the club left a big hole, and it needed to be filled. And I think what Pards did so well is he set goals for everyone. He managed the team, he managed the individuals well, and he managed the club really, really well. And there was a massive, when he vacated that, then there needed to be a complete rebuild from the bottom upwards. And Nicky Hammond was brought in to be the director of football, and they spent a long time. I remember, I think it took a long time to get Steve in. I don't remember. I just seem to remember we had four games. And I was thinking, when's a new manager coming in? We've got the seasons going on. We're losing game. We're missing out on games here. But and then when Steve came in, you know, he was brilliant. And the people respected him immediately. I mean, the guy's done over 1,000 games of management. He's one of those guys, Steve, that even if you don't like what he's saying, and if he's in there at half time and he's saying things and it's uncomfortable, you can't argue with what he's saying. I didn't necessarily like everything he said to me, because he might have said things that were critical and personal in terms of the way I was playing, but I could never go, Steve, you're out of order. You know, and there were other managers that in the heat of the moment used to pick on some because they were an easier target or something. And Steve was, you know, Steve was always fair. And, you know, it's no surprise to me. He's a good man, Steve Coppell, as everyone at the club knows. And it's no surprise to me that he did as well as he did for the club.
So you never had the offer to go and join him at West Ham then?
Yeah, in terms of, I did have a chance, actually. It was the, you know, someone says, you know, if you played in the Prem, I never played in the Premier League. And do I regret it? Well, when I left Reading, Pards did come in for me, and he just got promoted and they just got into Premier League. And he said, Foz, listen, I will sign you. But he was honest and said, look, we've got, it was at the time, Bobby Zamora, Marlon Harewood, Teddy Sheringham. And he said, I'm going to buy another striker, big name striker, he said. It turned out to be Dean Ashton. He said, and I've got all those four and I'll sign you, but you're going to be behind all those four in terms of first choice. So you won't play to start off with, and you might not be even on the bench. And I decided that I wanted to play football. So I opted to join Ipswich instead under Joe Roy.
And before you left Reading, say you faded a bit out of the team under Steve Coppell, maybe. What do you think were the reasons?
Well, I had a long-term sort of groin injury that we couldn't get to the bottom of, and it kept me out over sort of the Christmas and New Year period, and it was really frustrating. I went up to Manchester to see a groin specialist, a guy called Ian McClellan, and he did a groin. He said, you need a groin injury here, so a repair. So I had that done, and then it was sore still in around this area, and he said, you need the other side done. So that was another 3-4 weeks, and then that didn't cure it. And so in the end, I went to see a guy in Leicester, and he found out there was another issue, and that cured it. And in the end, I think that took about sort of 8-12 weeks, you know, of me not playing. And, you know, at that time, Kitson had come in, was doing well. We'd signed a couple of, we still had, I think Les Ferdinand was there at that time. And it was just... It just didn't. I don't know why. It just felt slightly different. It was maybe just the right time for me to move on. Why didn't it work? I don't know. I remember going to see Steve Coppell, and I was coming towards the end of the season that time, coming towards the end of my career, my contract. Sorry, at that time, and I said, "Look, Steve, you know, what's the situation with contract?" He said, "Well, I'm not too sure. I'm undecided." So I said, "Well, look, obviously it's playing on my mind. Obviously, you know, no contract increases pressure. Do you know what I mean?" He said, "But I can't give you a contract to ease pressure." And I, you know, so I said, "Look, I understand. I get it." And it, you know what, in the end, it was a sort of a mutual thing. And we just thought it was the right time. It was probably the right time for me to leave. It was the right time to look for a fresh challenge. And, you know, a couple of times I've left the club and they've gone and got promoted after I've left. So I'm actually I'm a good signing for a club, because when I leave, they go and get promoted in the following season. happened at Brentford, and it happened at Reading.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? I suppose leaving in the summer of 05, I mean, as a fan at the time, I remember being optimistic for the season that was coming up. I mean, you effectively got replaced by the first £1 million player at Reading in Leroy Lito, and you know, Kevin Doyle came in as well, but we didn't think he was going to be as good as he was going to be. So as you kind of left the club, what did you kind of feel about it and where it was heading? And obviously, you know, what it went on to do was probably beyond anyone's expectations.
The honest answer to that is I'm not someone I say that I don't look back, and that's what I've done for the last sort of hour here. But I'm not someone, when I move on and I've got a new challenge or a new thing, I focus on that purely. I'm looking at, okay, so how am I going to perform? How am I going to be good here? I don't look back and think, oh, how well are they going to do this season? It's just not a natural progression for me to progress forward, to channel my efforts to where I am and where I feel I need to go or where I want to go is always in front of me rather than looking back. So I didn't have a huge sort of thought process about how well Reading would do. I was amazed that they got beaten the first game. I can't remember who they got beaten by, but again, I think they lost the very first game at home.
Was it
like a 6-5 or something like that, or 5-4 or something ridiculous?
It was 2. They lost 2-1 first game season. Later on in the season, it was lost 3-2 against Luton on a Friday night. Those are the two.
Okay, I thought they lost the first game though, and I remember thinking at Reading or something, and I remember thinking, I can't believe that. And yeah, I was amazed because I thought they'd be strong. I certainly did think they'd be strong. I thought we, in terms of we at Ipswich, I thought we would be better than we were. But it soon became clear to me that Ipswich was a club that was, because we'd had big battles with Ipswich and played well against Ipswich over the previous couple of seasons. But it was soon apparent to me that Ipswich was a club really in that sort of shift of a balance of where they were as well. They were a club that was just finishing that sort of revolution of success, and were just going through a bit of a lull before they could pick up again.
And you had also a spell in management, briefly in charge of, as you said before, of a decent sized club like Brentford, as well as Dover and Staines. What were the biggest challenges you found?
The biggest challenges in terms of being a football manager is management of players. Players nowadays have more power than they've ever had before. So managing them, I mean, I just look at, you know, football at the moment, and certainly it resonates even now with coronavirus. And I look and see the Tottenham players have been caught out at parties over the new year. And, you know, it must be incredibly difficult for a manager, because you have to sort of toe the political line, and you want to sort of keep players on side, but you've got to publicly put them down for that, you know, that sort of behavior, and you're frustrated and almost annoyed in terms of, as a father figure, if your children let you down, you're not sometimes angry, you're disappointed, aren't you? And that's how I think you feel as a manager, and that's how I feel if players let you down. But we're all human. We all make good decisions and bad decisions along the way. And, I enjoyed management. I soon decided that I didn't want to be in it as a career. I came out, and, you know, as I say, I'm glad I got it on my CV. I was lucky enough and privileged enough to lead a team out at Wembley. We got to the Johnson's Plate final, and it was an incredible atmosphere, incredible experience. And I learned a lot off the guy who was put in alongside me, Mark Warburton, who's now the manager of QPR. I learned an awful lot of him.
Yeah, no doubt. And it was, as you say, you kind of you moved past management. You had that kind of stage in your career, and now I wondered if you could kind of, you know, as kind of the last sort of thing we wanted to talk about. It's been really, really interesting talking to you this evening. Last one thing we wanted to get from you is kind of what you're up to at the moment, and kind of talk us through what you're doing, because I understand there's kind of marathons, as you said, motivational speeches earlier. There's a wellness centre as well, I understand.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, listen, I came out of football and I went into management, decided I didn't want to do that. So I've always wanted to run a wellness centre or gym, if you like, whatever it was. So in 5 years ago, I opened up the Spot Wellness Centre, which is a small gym close to where I live in Godstone, Surrey. And we cater for, I'm a personal trainer by profession, and I train people, and we have an osteopath there, we have a masseur there. So it's a center really for the local area for people to come and train and train for whatever event they want. In terms of me, I still love exercise. I think the one thing that has made me realize as I get older that the thing I loved about football so much was the challenge, that the battle, the actual contest between me and an opponent in the game, but also myself in terms of setting myself goals and challenges. And I do that now with clients that come and see me at the gym. We've got five trainers that work there, and we've got 40, 50, 60 clients now that come in regularly. And what I started to do is see that there was a lot of this that resonates not only in terms of training, but also in terms of life as well. Some time ago now, I started talking and mentoring players and teams in the same way that PARDS came in and set up a goal sort of setting and set up a process to take a team that was underperforming, underachieving, and take them to a higher level. I now do that in terms of keynote speeches. I go into clubs and do goal setting seminars, workshops. And I also do it mentoring individuals. And, it's amazing to me how that there's not a lot of frameworks in place for players to actually do that, to actually help themselves, because it's only about 3% of adults actually set goals for themselves and actually set them out as a goal written down and then a process to take them from one place to a better place. And let's be honest, we set goals because we are in a position where we're not quite satisfied with where we currently are, and we want to get somewhere where we deem to be better. And that's what Pards did. And it, as I say, resonated inside of me. And now I spend my time talking to people and helping people, you know, decide that process, how they're going to get from position here, A, to position B. And I've been doing it for some time now, and it's difficult at the moment with coronavirus. A lot of stuff I do is online, but with my, certainly my speeches and things, I do touch on historical stuff that that has happened to me throughout my professional sports career. Because not only do I deal with professional sports, I go into business as well and talk to businesses and teams on how they can improve their targets. And I mean, To wrap up, really, I mean, I'm hugely proud of my career. I mean, I've come from just a local lad that got spotted in the right place at the right time. And, you know, then that process of trying to better myself, being hungry, has got me to where I am now. And if I look back for all the achievements we spoke of tonight and all the things that I'm hugely proud of, the players I've lined up and played with, David Beckham, Paul Gascoigne, Alan Shearer, and the promotions we've spoke about, the games like at the Madstad. For all those, I'm so proud of those. But the one thing that, or the two things that I'm proud of, and I think sum me up more than anything else, are the amount of goals I scored, which was 221, and the amount of games I played, which was 721, because, you know, a lot of players will reach 500 games maybe in their career. So 721 says a lot about me, especially with the injuries I had, long-term injuries. And also the goals that they say, I think they say a lot about me.
Absolutely, no doubt about that. And still occasionally tuning in to watch Reading these days?
I do, yeah. And, you know, you know, someone says to me, who do I support? And our family are West Ham fans, but I say, you know who I support? I support 8 different clubs, which are the 8 clubs I played for. And the 3 that I will always look for more than any other clubs are Reading, Brentford and Brighton. So they're the clubs that I look for. If Brentford and Reading were to get to the playoff final this year, I don't know. It's a tough one.
You can toss a coin.
Yeah, exactly right.
Oh, well, it's been brilliant chatting to you this evening, Nicky. Massive thanks for popping on. And Marco as well, a big thanks for you for helping out organise the interview and coming on tonight as well.
Yeah, sure. It's a pleasure.
It's been great to be on. Do you know what? The older we get, you know, certainly my kids don't want to hear and reminisce over my old stories. So I spent a few years at the end of football, and it's tough for footballers when they come out of the game, because they're immersed in it and it's like a bubble. Should I use that word? You know, with what's going on with the world at the moment, but football is like a bubble. And when you come out of it, it can be very lonely on the outside, as we've seen, and the mental health issues that men are talking about a little bit more, it's tough. And, you know, for a number of years when I came out of football, I didn't talk about it at all. You know, whether it was too painful or whether I never felt that it was, but I you know, I didn't reminisce much. So it's nice to come out and I'm comfortable with it now. And as I say, I've got good direction in my life. So it's nice to actually get some of the old stories out and talk about them again, because sometimes I forget that it was me that did it.
Well, you've got
that's what YouTube's for.
Absolutely. Oh yeah, that's how I did half the research for this interview, to be honest. But no, honestly, always happy to chat these sort of things, and thanks very much for coming on.
Yes, thank you very much, Nicky.
For all the latest Reading news, analysis and opinion, visit the website at thetilehurstend.com.